The following is intended for mature audiences only. Discretion is advised.
Thank you so much for downloading this episode of So What Do You Really Do, the podcast where I, your host, Dead Art Dennis Maller, talks to artists and entertainers about their day jobs. And the artist and entertainer on the podcast that we're talking to today is Claudia Bonavita, who is a comedian in New York and is the producer and writer for a brand new documentary called By Day, By Night, which is literally the tagline of this podcast. She's created a documentary with help of other people that is about the interesting day jobs of comedians. No, I'm not a part of the podcast or part of the documentary. Should have been, but she is a fascinating person. I so much enjoyed this conversation. I really didn't think I was going to have this much fun talking to her when she reached out to me. She's like, "Hey, you talk about day jobs. I did a documentary about day jobs and comedians. Can I come on the podcast?" And I'll be honest, anytime somebody wants to be on a thing, I cringe. I'm like, I want to have that selection. I want to choose who my guests are. I want to be the one that I want to be the moderator of who is interesting, whose day job is good enough to talk about. But I'm so glad that she reached out, because had I heard about the podcast, I would have reached out. And I'm glad that if I found out about her documentary. I'm so used to talking about podcasts. I've been saying the word podcast a lot lately because all I got right now is my podcast. A couple more weeks and we're back at work. For those who have followed the podcast for a while, you know what I'm talking about. You can see that I'm back at the home studio. I'm finally back in Boston after having 2 months and change out on the road and out in other cities doing comedy and just hanging out with my dog, who is named Sister, and having a good time. So I've been saying podcast a lot. So it's very much on the brain. Documentary is also harder to say than the word podcast. Podcast just rolls off the tongue. Documentary, too many syllables, but she created one. And that's what we talked about. She was also a special education teacher and had a fascinating career of 30 plus, almost 40 years teaching special education to children with disabilities in Long Island. We get into the nomenclature. We make sure that we get all the correct ways of saying it down. So don't worry about that. And I'm a fan of it. I'm not going to be like, "You can't say anything anymore." That's not where I'm not that kind of person at all. But so yes, the podcast is all I've had. I'm so glad that we did this one. The only other thing I do have, I will talk about this. I do have this, the merch store is back, and they're there. Go to deadairdennis.com, click on store. We have t-shirts that are inspired by some of my jokes. More t-shirt designs will be coming soon. And we have podcast mugs in. We have new podcast mugs in multiple colors. And if there's a mug in a color you want, let me know. I'll find it for you. I'll make it for you. We got it on water bottles. So deadairdennis.com, then click on store. I'm sure there is a .com/this/that, whatever. I don't know what it is off the top of my head. And it's just either go to deadairdennis.com, click on store. These things support me. I make money off these. If you like the podcast, if you like my comedy, that is a way to support me directly. There, done, said. The pitch is out there. The merch is there. If you want to go pick some of it up, I would greatly appreciate it. It's up to you. What is not up to you, or what you've already made a decision on, is listening to this podcast. And I hope you listen, continue to keep listening, and enjoy my conversation with teacher, producer, and comedian, Claudia Bonavita. I gotta tell you, since you are a Long Islander, best breakfast bagel sandwich I ever had was in Long Island.
Wally's.
No, It was Delicacies Gourmet over by Roslyn Pond.
All right, I was over at Roslyn Pond yesterday. No, I never tried them, but Wally's is noted for being number one on Long Island.
Okay, next time I'm in Long Island, I'm going to try out Wally's.
North Babylon.
We're going to put it to the test, yeah. But in the defense of my saying it was the best, I was out there for a work event. I used to do sound for a traveling dance company, and we were at the hotel around the corner. I walked out there. It was a nice, early spring day. It was moist in the
air. Beautiful there.
There's like a water mill thing going on.
Yes.
The nice Roslyn Pond itself. And I just sat out there overlooking the water, eating the sandwich. And I was like, man,
You could have eaten a shit sandwich and you probably would have had the same reaction.
I don't know. I feel like I'm going to get a palate.
The best sandwich, man. Look at the view.
The ambiance added to the deliciousness
of this
sandwich. There's
dew forming on my glasses. Shit sandwich is the best.
Yes, it was a very, very, like, honestly, wasn't mad that the bagel wasn't even toasted. It was just like a cold bagel, which I'm like, in what world do people eat just cold, untoasted bagels? And then I had that sandwich, like, oh, there's a difference. I get it.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I got it. This is good. This is gooey in a different way. Like, every time I eat a bagel that's not toasted or not toasted enough, I'm like, it feels half cooked. I feel
yes.
like it's still raw.
It has that mush to it. I get it.
So did you teach in Long Island?
Yes. So I taught for 32 years for Eastern Suffolk BOCES as a special education teacher. And I specialized with students with autism. And then I became...
I mean, I'm not going to, I'm not from New York. I live in Boston. I'm from Baltimore. But I'm going to say, aren't all new Long Islanders specially educated? Isn't that... Ah.
There you go. Ha, nice, nice.
That's it. That's that Orioles fan coming out at that Yankees
fan. There
you
go.
That's all. There we go.
How'd you know I wasn't a Met fan? But I'm too good.
I mean, because I've seen how the Mets have been performing.
No
one's a fan.
Well, the story is, so I grew up a Met fan. My mother was a huge baseball fan, and my grandmother both loved the Mets. So I grew up a Met fan, then I got married to a Yankee fan. And he was in the bedroom watching the Yankees. I'm in the living room watching the Mets. I said, this is no way to have a marriage. So I became a Yankee fan, and my son was born 9 months later.
Well, also, like, when your mom and grandmother were Mets fans, that's when the Metropolises were good.
69 Mets. You got it.
Yeah.
It was great.
So, you know what? It's okay that you're like, you know what? Maybe I'm going to change allegiances because one of them has become the superior team.
True.
Up until last season.
Right, yeah. Last season was sad.
But no, it's teaching. Let's talk about that. Why did you get into teaching? Because I find it interesting, the people that get into certain fields, because, you know, it's a family trade or something inspires them. For you as a teacher, especially when it comes to special education, which, by the way, in 2024, special education, or saying special ed, still feels like an insult. Like, it feels like I'm going to be...
No, I understand. That's what we're trained in. But, you know, students with disabilities... So I started as a cellist. I'm a cello player.
Oh,
I went
nice.
To Fredonia School of Music. I went for 3 semesters and I studied music therapy, which I didn't really like, couldn't connect with. It wasn't my jam. But while I was doing music therapy, I was working with little kids who had disabilities. And I was like, that I could do every day. And so at the time, back in the 1980s, there were only like 2 schools that had music therapy, which was Fredonia all the way upstate. And that's where I went, one of the 2 schools. And so if I was going to go for special ed, well, I was going to be away from my boyfriend, who's now my husband, and I might as well come home. So I came home and studied special education, fell in love, loved the kids, loved the job. And I did it for 32 years. I retired 2 weeks before the pandemic. That's
timing.
Yeah, February 28th, 2020, I was out, and it was the last retirement party that my school had for years because couldn't have large gatherings. They didn't want to have, you know, usually more than one person retires at a time. I retired mid-year because I turned of age and had the years. And I said, you know, I started stand-up comedy a year before, and I said, there's so many other things I want to do with life. That I'm going to retire when I can. I have a pension, God bless. That's a good thing. And
being a full-time comedian is a lot easier when you have a non-working
pension.
Income coming in.
Yes.
You know, I can't
deny that.
Well, let's not get too far ahead because I am curious about the special education thing. Because growing up, I was in the Boy Scouts.
Yes.
And we did a lot of service programs with, you know, people with disabilities and mental disabilities and stuff. And I found it difficult. Like, I did well working with, you know, having the patience to work with mentally disabled individuals. But I found it to be a thing where I was like, I'm great at this today, but I can't do this every day. Fast forward 30 years, later, you know, I'm an adult now. And what my day job is I'm a tour guide here in Boston. And I work with not a lot, but occasionally some really you know, very handicapped people.
People with disabilities.
People with disabilities. Sorry. Yeah. I'm trying to make sure I get the
nomination. Put the person first. And then.
Yes. Like, with, on that note, with this job, since we're here in Massachusetts, we talk, you know, about slavery a lot. And then I had to make sure that I've changed my language to saying those who were enslaved.
Wow.
Yeah, instead of slaves. You know,
right.
Which is right.
Right.
It's the right way to say it. It's the yeah, much better way of saying things. But anyway, so working with people with disabilities, guests who are like, you know, it's I found the patience. It took me 30 years, but I found the patience. And I got to say, hats off to the people that can do this every day. I don't know if I can. I feel like I can. I've had enough great reviews. I had enough. Like, the day I got a review from somebody's parent, parent that was like, my child has autism, and to see them have enough trust in Dennis's character to go up to the front of the tour vehicle and drive it, and seeing that they could be, that they had a good time and could interact that they normally don't do.
That's
I was
awesome.
Like, oh, jeez, God, I didn't know that they would do this to me. Yeah. And so I never felt that reward until that review came in, and, you know, working with other, just seeing the look on a parent, like when you deal really well with somebody who has a severe disability,
that's,
even like
that's
minor
amazing.
Autism is difficult. But when somebody who's like nonverbal, and
that's has, my jam.
Yeah. That, I can only deal with verbal things because my job has been radio, stand up, acting, and voiceover.
There you
like,
go.
All I have is my voice.
Your voice. Yeah. No.
But so it's like, did you find that reward?
I did.
Over
so,
32 years?
Yes. Yeah. So I started with preschoolers with disabilities, and then I was with multiply disabled, so severely disabled. They had more than one, usually intellectual, physical, health issues. And I loved it. And I came back off of maternity leave, and I was given a class of 6 students with autism. And all I knew about autism is what I had learned in college. And we did not know in the 80s what we know in the 90s, even just 10, you know, a decade later. And I started to work with the kids, and the students were, when I tell you, out of control, the behaviors I had never seen. No disrespect to my students. I had a young man. He was over 6 feet tall. He would strip naked and jump out the fire escape. And I'm running across a school lawn chasing after him to get him back in the school. And there's a whole, you know, class of people jumping out the windows after me, helping me. And, you know, so there were behaviors I never saw. You know,
the good thing about that is you now have a secondary career in chasing down streakers at
yes, definitely. Definitely. I'd jump right over that wall. As a matter of fact, it's funny. One day I was walking out of a store and a little kid was running by himself, had to be maybe a 2-year-old. And I just scooped the kid up, and the mother came over and was like, oh, my God, thank you. Thank you. He was running toward the street. I go, this is what I do for a living. Here you go. She just looked at me like very puzzled.
Are you a teacher of special educated students or a superhero?
Yeah.
What
what is that profession? So it was a little wacky, but so I had all these really severe behaviors, nonverbal students, intellectually disabled. And there was a speech therapist who was next door to me who was servicing my kids for speech. And he said, you know, looks like you're having a tough time. And I was like, yes. And he's like, do you want some help? And I said, yes. And he started to work with me, and he said, listen, if you want to team teach next year, I'm going to give you some books to read over the summer. And he gave me a stack of books that had to be about 3 feet high. And I was like, what are you, nuts? I have 2 kids, a husband, you know, summer.
I already went to college.
Right. But I did. I read them. I read the books. I came back in September, and we were given a student who at 7 years old was thrown out of every school on Long Island. And this was the last stomping ground, was to be in our class. And not only did we work with that child and make great gains with that child, but that child was the reason my partner and I, my speech therapist partner and I, made a school for kids with autism. So we started an entire school from the ground up, and we traveled around the country. We saw the best programs there were. We saw LOVAS in California. We went up to Oregon. We went into Rhode Island and saw the Grodin Center, met with these people, and then came back to Long Island and started one of the first programs that Eastern Suffolk BOCES had for kids with autism. And that was in existence up until about 5 years ago, and then the program disbanded. But, you know, it was around for quite many years, and we did some great things with the students back then. Funny story, the speech therapist that I started the program with, his son is the director of my movie.
Don't skip ahead. We'll talk about John.
Just letting you know.
That you're teasing it up. I am curious because you brought it up. You started in the 80s. We're in 2024 now. You retired in 2020. You know, that's 35 years almost of working in the industry. And
yes.
You brought up what we know now, we didn't know then. Like, we didn't know what we didn't know then. And then 10 years later, we knew
and
more.
And tomorrow we'll learn more.
What are the biggest changes? Yeah. What has been the biggest changes in autism, special education, since when you started to the time you retired?
Well, when I first started, my thesis for college was how students with Down syndrome would use sign language to communicate. And it proved to be a horrible thing because no disrespect, but their hands they have stubbier fingers, broader pads in there. And so to make, they, you know, cookie is this or whatever, this is cookie. They do this and somebody would know, well, only the person who's with them 24 hours a day that knows that this, you know, rough approximation is cookie. And so we've learned through using picture symbols, and now we have electronic devices, how to get inside, you know, the minds of kids who are intellectually impaired and have autism, and how to get them to communicate. So we've learned so much in that respect. I think diagnostically, we've learned a lot. I know of some people who weren't diagnosed with autism till they were adults, because back in the 60s and 70s, we didn't have the same diagnostic tools or knowledge that we have now. They've done scans of brains of people post-mortem who had autism, and they could see structurally the brain is different in people with autism. You know, and so that's something we didn't know. And I used to be, so when I first started, I was a teacher. Then I started the program with my colleagues, Norma Drossman and Vito Selecchia, and the three of us made this school. So we wrote ourselves jobs, right? I'm no dope. If I'm going to make, you know, a grant and say, here's the school. Oh, guess who's going to be the coordinator? Vito. Guess who's going to be the staff trainer? Claudia. Guess who's going to be, you know, so we gave us all jobs. And BOCES bought it hook, line, and sinker. And so I was taken out of the classroom and made to look over the crisis team, to be a consultant to all the classrooms, and to develop training. And so I had to be up on the latest research. So I traveled all over the place, Toronto, you know, I don't know, all over the United States, to go to conferences to learn the most recent methodology. And then I brought it back to our school and then set up training programs.
Dealing with people who have a disability, especially high functioning, or is the opposite of high functioning?
There's
low functioning?
There's a spectrum, okay. And you're on either spectrum. One end of the spectrum. So you're more academic or more life skills. I'd like to see it, you know. But within that spectrum, you know, I had a young man who did great in college, graduated from college, you know, summa cum laude, very bright young man who can't tie his shoes. So there's gaps and skills, you know.
Well, what I'm concerned with is, which is the bigger, who is it, who's more difficult dealing with?
Both
the children,
both very
or the
ends.
Parents.
Oh, very good question. So, all right.
Cuz you know that even like just children have difficult parents in general sometimes.
True.
And I can imagine I've been fortunate enough that the people with disability that I've dealt with have very appreciative, very patient parents.
Yes.
I know in a world, I live in a world where there are not patient parents, even
right.
when it comes to children who are not disabled, whether they're impatient with their kids, whether they're impatient with the people around them to deal with their kids. I mean, look at how, just put into YouTube, parent fights at Little League. You're going to get a lot of impatient parents. Is there been parents of children who you have dealt with was like...
So in 32
you
years...
You want to teach them how to deal with
your
kid, maybe?
In 32 years, I've had more positive experience than negative, but there have been a few negative that you have to really say to yourself, this is as best as I can do to help this parent be the best that they can do. And that's it. But I will tell you along those lines, because I'm a lunatic. You're going to find that out, Dennis. I tell my students, if it doesn't exist, invent it. I've never done half the things I've done in the last 4 years since I retired, and I just made it up, you know? So along those lines, we had a thing called parent training, and really became coffee clutching, where, you know, staff would go into the home of the parent, and you really weren't making gains. One thing, there was no curriculum for the parents. There was no way to teach the parents what we knew to bring into the home. And it wasn't structured enough. So again, a bunch of colleagues, myself included, said we need to change and revamp parent training. So I'm an idiot, and I gave BOCES for free instead of selling it, an entire parent training curriculum that I created. And I actually researched online these table tents that it's like a binder that stands up. And I created PowerPoint presentations and stuck them in the binder so that you could train the parents on the various skills that we knew. And then I made a script. Sit down facing the parent. Open up the table tent. Turn to the first slide. Say, and it would say on it, "Hi, today we're going to be learning about visual schedules and how to make visual schedules in the home. Turn the page." So literally, Dennis, you could sit in somebody's kitchen with the materials and train the parent how to do what we do. You know, give a man a fish, teach a man to fish.
Yeah, and it's the training or the education for children doesn't stop at the front door of the school.
Exactly.
You know, if you have a child who is not disabled, you can teach them math, science, like you went through the same program. Parent who has not ever had to deal with a person who is disabled, other than they now have it, they have to figure that out too, and they have to figure out how to raise their kid, but also how to raise their
and the lingo
with the disability.
Yeah,
and the
CSE, the IEP, and they're like, "What?" You know, the best example I ever had, I had a father sit at a CSE meeting, and everybody's throwing out these, you know, acronyms: at CSE, IEP, IDEA, ADHD, ASD. And the father goes, stop. I want to know what is the height from a windowsill to the ground in a home in the town of Babylon. And everybody looked at this father and were like, "What?" And he goes, "That's what I do for a living. And I know it. I don't expect you to know what I know for my job, but don't expect me to know what you know for yours." I was blown away. And I tell my students, because I also am a college professor. I'm a professor at St. Joseph's University in Patchogue, and I teach students become special ed teachers. And I tell them, you know, that story that, you know, don't start talking in lingo to these parents, to the parents that just, this is not what they do for a living.
What got you into comedy? Where, for me, I'm going to tell you my story is that I grew up there's an age difference between us, but not much of one. You should be old enough to remember the things that I shouldn't know, like the late 70s, early 80s, or the 70s, late 70s to 80s comedy boom. I grew up as a kid watching stand-up comedy on TV all the time. And then somewhere in the early to mid-90s, it went away. And then in the early 2000s, it came back and it was everywhere. And we're now in 2024 and it's everywhere. And it's a big discussion point. But I grew up with stand-up comedy everywhere, on TV, in person, people talking about it, comedy specials and CDs coming out, all the vinyl records. You know, party records and stuff like that. I grew up around
Bill Cosby, the dentist. I got the thing. I mean, all that. Yeah.
My parents took us to a timeshare presentation so we could get a free portable black and white television. And while they were in the presentation for 4 hours, me, my brother, and my sister just sat in the waiting room watching the same Bill Cosby special over and over over. And I'm fully aware of what his reputation is now, but then I did it.
True.
I mean, I repeated his jokes in schools, like talking to telling the story to my teachers. Like, for the longest time, I thought that my brother's name was Damn It and my name was Jesus Christ. And
yeah.
We were out in the rain and he goes, "Damn it, get in here." I went, "Dad, I'm Jesus Christ." I woke up a week later. Like, and they're like, "We're going to call Child Protective Service." I'm like, whoa, calm down. It's Bill Cosby. Anyway. Which, by the way, on second thought, don't calm down. It's Bill Cosby. Anyway,
exactly.
Point being, I always knew that stand-up comedy was a job. I always knew it was a profession. I knew it was a craft, right? Because I studied it as a kid. I knew that this was something. Not everybody was that fortunate to know. Some people just thought it's a magical thing that only certain people are gifted and comedy only comes from divine intervention. Lightning strikes you in the brain and that's where jokes come from. Well, meanwhile, right. Now it's A plus B equals C. Setup plus punchline equals laughter.
That's like, right. Exactly.
It's formulaic, you know, like it's a craft of writing. It's like storytelling and anything else, you know, writing prose and whatnot. There's a formula. So for you as an adult who's in the education world, what made you want to become a stand-up comedian?
All right. So I liked to entertain. So as a little kid, I was 5 years old and my sisters are 6 years older than I am. They were in Girl Scouts, speaking of Boy Scouts, and they needed somebody to be a leprechaun during St. Paddy's Day. And they sang, look, look, look to the rainbow. And I came out and threw gold coins and everybody applauded. And I was 5 years old, and I was like, wow, this is cool.
There's that dragon you've been chasing your whole life.
Got it. And then my mother was an entertainer. She could sing, she could dance, she could act. She was amazing. She passed away, but she was a great actress and singer. And I just got that bug and started doing, you know, shows in school and theater in school, in high school. I went to a music school, you know, for 3 semesters and whatever, Fredonia School of Music. And I always had that bug, like the theater, to perform. Well, then I became a staff trainer, and now I'm standing in front of a captive audience and training. And, you know, even with college, 2004, I started teaching college. If I don't make it interesting, fun, and make those students laugh and have a good time, it is a torturous 3 hours for both of us. So I would throw in a joke here and there, and they were the same jokes because I'm teaching the same content. So I would have the same, you know, topic, premise, punch, kind of, you know, anecdote or story. And I liked that feedback from the crowd. And people would say, oh, I love going to your trainings because you're so entertaining. And so I liked it. So what happened that really started it all, I was a year away from retirement and about 18 months away. And I went to a comedy show. My friend's niece had a softball fundraiser. So we're sitting there and there's a pamphlet for stand-up university at Governor's, at Brokerage, with Peter Bales and Rich Walker. And I'm like, oh, man, when I retire, I said to my husband, this is what I'm going to do. And he was like, oh, really? I said, no, I swear I'm going to take this class. So he took a flyer, unbeknownst to me, and for Christmas that year, he gave it to me as a gift.
Aw, so supportive.
Yes, so you have no idea. I mean, I sing an extremely inappropriate song about him, and he's in the front row singing the song, and, you know, meanwhile, I'm saying these awful things. He's great. We're together 41 years. So,
wow, congratulations.
Thank you. We're married 35.
Your marriage is almost as old as I am.
Yeah, 35 years we're married, but we're together 41 years. But he's a great guy, so he got me the class. I took the class and, you know, it's like a dance recital. You learn how to dance and then you do the recitals. You learn how to do comedy and then you have a graduation and you invite friends and family. And it's very, you know, it's a positive experience because everybody there wants you to do well. I left the graduation with a paid gig, which is unheard of. The teacher.
Well, it's because most of these classes, no offense to the class that you take, I'm not going to throw. I don't know your teacher, but a lot of these classes are just money grabs.
Not stand up. You, I can't say
there
enough.
Are some good. Yeah, no, there are, I know, good classes out there. There are good classes out there, but a lot of them is just somebody who, you know, is
get up and talk, and they're just gonna, hey, yeah, that's funny. Yeah, no,
yeah. They. Or it's the old adage: those who can't do the teach, you know.
No, they're both professional comedians for a living.
Good. And that's great that you got a real actual gig out of it because sometimes you do the classes and then. That's where it ends.
That night at graduation, there was a woman in the audience who owned a theater, and she said, you know, here's my card. Would you perform at my theater? And I was like, yeah. But I here's the thing. Like, at the class, at the graduation, the teacher pulled my husband aside and said, you don't realize it, but things are going to be different. Like, she's going to perform. So he was like, what are you talking about? Things are going to be different. But long story short, I don't take anything lightly. I think you could tell I'm a lunatic. If, like I said, if it doesn't exist, I invent it. So when I took this class, you know, they were like, okay, tonight's homework for next week is write down this, that, and the other, and then formulate it into this. And then they actually give you a printout of how to formulate the joke. What's the topic? What's the premise? What's the punchline? You know,
I love that.
It's amazing.
I have not taken a comedy class. I've taken a lot of workshops. I have friends who have taught classes. I have friends who have taken classes. And I always ask about the academic side of it. And so many classes are just like joke pitch workshops where it's like, all right, come in with your material and then we'll all try and pitch around and see if you can better. And it's like,
no,
you need to teach them the craft. Like, teach them what constitute as a premise, what constitute as a setup, what constitute as a punchline,
and what
an act out is.
Yes, exactly. So I learned all my foundation skills there, and they were so good. They really do teach. And you were there for hours. You got your money's worth. I mean, it was I'm not even exaggerating, like 12:45, 1 o'clock in the morning, we're still sitting there. And I'm like, all right, listen, I love you all, but I got work in the morning. And I got to go, you know. But they gave you your money's worth. And so how they structure it is 5 weeks you prepare your material to help you write it. The first class is they get you on stage. They, you know, teach you the whole etiquette, put the mics in behind. But they interview you. And from that interview and the questions that they ask, they're pulling out information for premises and, you know, now giving you work to do before you come back. And so there were people who went every week and never did. You could tell they did nothing. So they'd come back. I don't know. I think we were talking about a pizza place. I'm not sure. And I'm like, are you out of your mind? I had a notebook. I'm taking notes. I have Judy's Carter's book. I'm reading underneath the table. Like, what are you people, nuts? You're spending your money on this, you know? But that's what I did. And so I did it by the book, literally. You know, what I was learning from them, what I was learning from reading, from researching. And so then the last class, you watch yourself on stage and they critique. And they have bookers there. So the bookers are now watching your recorded, you know, video and helping you with, you see right there, you stepped on the laughter. You should have waited a little longer, you see. And so now you're seeing yourself. And it was a great class. I've taken other classes. I took Second City in Chicago. I was there twice. I went for stand-up one and stand-up two. Very different. If you don't have a basis of the, you know, how to set up a punchline and cut the fat and all the, you know, the basics, it's a little high level. But because I had that foundation, it was a very different way to teach stand-up. I loved it. I couldn't get enough of it. But it was just a whole different mindset. Whole different way of writing, brainstorming, you know. And then I still belong to, it's such a long story, but I'll try and make it short. There's something that was in existence up until November that was called Joke Zoom. And it was an international joke writing workshop that took place, are you ready for this? Every single day of the week. 365 days a year with people all over the world. I have a friend in Cyprus, I have a friend in New Zealand, in Toronto, in California, Kansas, Kentucky, Florida, I'm trying to think, Germany, I mean, like, all, Ireland, England, and at certain times. So what happened was, in November, we all went to go log on at 6 in the morning, because we're lunatics, but 6 in the morning, and we couldn't get on, and come to find out that the man who invented this whole thing had a heart attack and passed away.
Oh, jeez.
So the comedy community on Long Island was just devastated. Rob Chiaffi, and my movie is dedicated in memory of Rob, because he was just a great guy. So I took classes with him. He was like comedy on crack, because no, I can't even. He sent you daily videos. He sent you challenges, writing prompts every day, 365 days a year. He sent he had a 6-hour boot camp that if you wanted to be part of Joke Zoom, you had to take the 6-hour boot camp, which was interactive. You watched a movie, like a little clip, and then there were questions you had to answer, and then to go to the next level. And it was nuts, but I learned so much for him as well. You know, it's like every level kind of just keeps adding more and more information. But we still meet, believe it or not, Mondays and Thursdays at 6 a.m. You'll find me on my computer with people from all over the world.
Well, I mean, that is one of the best things that came out of the pandemic, for me at least. A lot of people hated Zoom comedy. Was like, hey, look, right. I made friends with other comedians across the country.
Yes.
And across the world. So, you know, there are good things that came out of it.
I agree.
I'm still, 4 years later, still meeting pandemic friends in person and confirming that we all do, in fact, have legs. Except for the ones that don't have legs. I confirmed that they didn't have legs and they weren't lying to us.
There you go. Yeah.
So, after class and now that, after your graduation, how did you find navigating the New York comedy scene?
So, you know, it starts out with All Bringers, as everything does, which is, for those people who don't know what that is, you can get stage time if you bring a certain amount of people. So you bring five people and you'll get, 5 to 7 minutes on stage. So I started out doing that. And then, so I graduated in February. In May, I entered a contest, Aragona's Comedy Contest for Suffolk County. I don't know if you know anything about Long Island, but Suffolk County's pretty huge. And I won the contest, so that was March, April, May. That was 3 months after I finished the comedy class. So I was, I won for Suffolk County 2019. And the producer who runs that Aragona's Comedy, John Butera, he started booking me on shows. And then it's funny, but, I've learned this thing. Shonda Rhimes wrote a book, Say Yes, or something about yes. It has to do with, you never say no, say yes to everything, I actually have a quote in my mirror.
Also a Jim Carrey movie.
Oh, yeah, just say yes, right? So he would say to me, I know you've done 7 minutes with me. You have 10 minutes? Yeah, I got 10 minutes. And I go, write 3 minutes. And then, or write six and take the best three. Can you feature? Sure, sure. And now I'm calling up my friend. What does it mean to feature? Oh, that's right before the headliner. Okay. And can you do 12 minutes? Sure, I could do 12 minutes. And then he was, do you know how to host? Yeah, of course I know how. I had no clue. Yeah, sure, I know how to host. And then go
fake it till you make it.
You got it. Go to my friends. How do I host? What do I do? I still.
Can you ride a horse? I got a saddle in the trunk.
You got it. Let's go. Saddle up. So I basically just said yes to everything. And then winning that contest, I got a headlining gig. And then he started booking me more to headline. And then I started getting other bookers to book me through, word of mouth, friends. Oh, I know somebody. Can you fill in for me? Another comedian would say, this happened, that happened. Can you do it for me? And I'll call the guy. And now I'm doing work for that guy, And so I now work for a bunch of different, producers who put me on shows. Laughter Saves Lives with John LaRocchia. And like I said, John Butera and Alan Streisfeld. And so wherever they call, that's another thing. Are you willing to go to Connecticut? Sure. You willing to go to upstate New York? Sure. And you just never know. I was asked one time to do 5 minutes at a restaurant about an hour and a half away up in North Salem, New York, which is the border of Massachusetts. And, supposedly all these rich people live in this neighborhood and whatever. I said, sure, and I didn't even know who asked me. I don't know the guy's name. I was like, sure, somebody emailed me. So I asked my sister, you want to go on an adventure? We'll go drive upstate. Yeah, sure. So we go. And everybody goes up, and now I'm featuring, and I'm thinking, this guy doesn't even know me. He's got me feet. All right, so I go to do my 5 minutes, and he's doing this. And I'm like, okay, and I just keep going and going and going, and now we're up to 12
He's
minutes.
Giving you the stretch it, keep
yeah, stretch, keep going, and I'm like, okay, so I just keep going and going, and I have things chunked. I have jokes about my son, jokes about, observational, jokes about my husband, jokes about weight loss. So I'm just doing that whole run, and we're up to about 12 minutes, and I'm like, all right, maybe I'm misinterpreting this, and I'm going to get in trouble, because I know going over is really bad. So I wrap it up. And he goes, why'd you stop? I didn't stop you. And I went, oh my God, I thought I was in trouble. Like, I started to get nervous. You said 5 minutes and we're up to 12 minutes and I'm still up here. And he goes, the audience was loving you. I was going to let you stay on. And I was like, geez, I'm so sorry. But all right, long story short, go to New York City and I'm at a show and that guy walks in. Claudia, what are you doing? So now somebody I met upstate in a restaurant is down here. And now he's like, what are you doing Thursday night? You think you could do this, that, or the other? Yeah, sure. And it just led to more and more things where it was, hey, you want to do 5 minutes upstate at a restaurant? Sure, let me try it. And, you never know.
Did you ever have difficulties relating to some of the other comedians who are not in your age bracket? Because sometimes I find it, even at 42, difficult dealing with 22-year-olds. Not that I'm the problem, but, you know.
No,
there's an uncomfortableness between age differences.
So, I mean, a lot of the comedians that I work with are in their 20s, you know. And, I hate to tell you, but I'm very blue.
Yeah.
I'm not as filthy. I got to tell you, some of the 20-year-olds get a little ridiculous and aren't funny. They're just filthy. Like, okay, where's the punchline? Yeah. You know, I'm sorry.
2023, I've been doing a lot of traveling again in 2023. And one of the things that I've been noticing is there's so much more. I feel like more than ever right now is the problem of people are trying to be offensive and not funny.
Yes.
And I don't know what happened. Like, we were kind of getting to a point where people were understanding the difference between being offensive for offensive sake and making a joke that just happens to be offensive. And I feel like we've lost all of that nuance. And I'm not talking about in the Boston scene. I've been, in the past year and a half, I've been to LA, Dallas, Austin, New York, Louisiana, all around New England.
Cool.
Maryland, DC.
Take me with you.
Mid-Atlantic. Yeah. It's like, I've had a lot of traveling this year, and
awesome.
It's everywhere. It's everywhere. True. Every scene's the same.
You know what I'm thinking too is, you know, there are, like you said before, you said, you know, this is the right way to say it. People who are enslaved, like, so there is a lot of political correctness, and I don't think it was ever funny, some of the things that, you know, people made fun of in the 60s, 70s, 50s, whatever, and we're learning from that. I don't know if you watched old TV shows and you go, oh my God, how did they get away with that? That's horrible, you know, and now we can see it for what it was and you know, whatever. But I think the filth that I hear sometimes on stage is all directed about sex, and I feel like, well, we're not making fun of a race, of an ethnicity, of a religion, of a, let's just be shocking, you know, for shocking's sake. And it, to me, some of that stuff just isn't funny.
I don't know if you know Paul Verzey. He's a New York comedian, but he be pretty big now. Like, he's Bill Burr's, like, Bill Burr's second command. He produced his special. Great comedian. He was saying on the podcast a while back that, I asked him about becoming a father, if it's changed his material. He's like, yeah, it's made my material better because I have a life worth living. I have experiences. And when I was a 22-year-old kid, I talked about my dick all the time because I had no life experience and all I knew was my dick. And there is a lot of truth in that, where it's like, you have to live a life worth living to talk about.
It's true.
Right?
It's a great point.
Yeah, you know, he brought up a good point of that. And that's the same thing. What a lot of youths don't have the experience to talk about, a life experience. So they're like, I'm going to talk about the only thing that goes through my mind 24/7 is my constant erection.
Right. Exactly. That's a great point. Yeah. I'd have to agree with that.
All right. So we've been talking about your very interesting past, history employment, which is why you're on this podcast.
Yes.
Because my podcast is, the inspiration for this was, I was hanging out at a Christmas party with a comedy club Christmas party, and me and a couple comedians are talking and we're jiving, and one of the comedians that I was talking to is a video game designer. We were talking about the video game. He designed a video game for Marvel Comics.
Wow. Growing
up, comic book fan.
Yeah.
Hey, let's talk about how you manage people who had to draw Captain America for a video
awesome.
Game.
Awesome.
And I was like, this is what my podcast needs about. I worked in radio for years, and I didn't want to just be another comedian. I didn't want to be another white guy comedian with a podcast talking about, hey, why shouldn't we be able to say the N-word? Like, I wanted to have a podcast that had a reason to interview people. And that was the day that I was like, oh, day jobs. You have an interesting day job. I'm fascinated by it. Other people are going to be fascinated by it. I worked in radio for 20 years. I have a fascinating job. Everyone asks me about my fascinating job. I'll talk to us who have fascinating jobs. You working not just as a teacher, but as a special education teacher who created the program for special education,
yes.
Basically. You have an interesting background. Was that the inspiration for you to make the documentary By Day, By Night, working to make people laugh?
So, yeah, basically, because I started to meet people who had really interesting day jobs. And like you're saying, you're like, and they're making people laugh at night. Like, there's something about that intrigued me. So I had contacted, because I was all over the place with my first idea. Let's do this. Let's do that. You know, So I call this kid who's in his 20s, who is, like I said, Vito Selecki's son, John Selecki. And I'm like, John, I got an idea for a documentary. And I'm all over the place. And he goes to me, Claudia, stop. One theme, call me back. When you get one idea and one theme, let me ask you,
how much of this was experience in the business and how much of it was, you're a lot right now. If I just tell you something, will you go away and never?
Yeah, I'm sure that's probably it. Yeah. So of
what's
course,
your chagrin? You're like, I'm going to follow through.
Yeah, of course. He hasn't met me. Okay. So I follow through. So I'm thinking. And I said, you know, the crazy thing is I had the title before I had anything else. By day, by night, working to make people laugh. And I'm like,
see, that was the thing about the podcast. I didn't have the title. And at that same party, I pitched it. And one of the other comedians goes, you need to make the podcast have a catchy name. Like, you know, yeah, you're a comedian, but what do you really do? I was like, so what do you really do? That's
yes.
The name. And then, you know, 8 months later, I have that comedian on and totally forgot that he pitched me the name of my own podcast.
That's funny. Yeah, so that's where I came up with this idea, and then I called him back, and he goes, okay, write a treatment. So I'm like, okay. I hang up the phone, and I start Googling, you know, documentary treatments. What's a documentary treatment? And online, you know, I did this deep dive. I found, like, a PowerPoint presentation, a Prezi, on how to write a documentary treatment. And I was flipping out. I'm like, oh, my God. So I'm looking through that. Then I looked online for templates for movie treatments, and then there's specific for documentary. I did the Ken Burns master class on how to make a documentary, and I just, you know, Skillshare and whatever I could do to find out. So I write this treatment, and, you know, it's yay thick, and I go to Staples and have it bound because, you know, I'm a teacher. And I
put
call
in
this
all those extra little miles.
You got it. And I call, and it's all about how it looks, right? How do we present? So I call him up and I said, I'll meet you at Panera Bread. And so we go to Panera to have coffee and I hand him the treatment and his face is just like, wow, cool. So he starts reading it and everything and he goes, I'm in. So I'm like, really? He's like, yeah. So I'm like, okay, do you know people who are cameramen? And he goes, I have camera, crew, cameras, and, you know, I'll direct. So I was like, all right, cool. So he called up all his friends he went to college with, and then he and I met and made a schedule. What do we want to do? How do we want to do it? You know, who are we going to look at? So we originally had a different cast. We had one person who never showed up for a shooting. Now, mind you, I'm renting cameras. I'm getting a space. I'm paying for the crew. I mean, it was insane, and the guy just blew us off. And that got me nuts. But then I asked somebody else, and they ended up...
You forgot about the unreliability of comedians.
Comedians.
Being a comedian yourself.
Right? Don't you think? You got to be kidding. You know what's funny is being a teacher and a comedian, I go to open mics. I'm the only one with paper and a pencil. Everybody's like, oh, you got a bar napkin. Hey, did anybody have a pen? I'm like, here it is. You know. But so... I wrote the
You're
treatment.
You're the open mic mom.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you.
I mean, that wasn't an age thing. That was the one that takes care of everything. It sounds better than the mother hen. It sounds like when I see bachelorette parties, like I used to work at a hip hop club and we would have bachelorette parties come in. And our job, our fun was spotting which one is the mother hen, which is who's the responsible one in the group that's going to hold the hair back when the bride
when they're puking.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, you were the mother hen at open mics because you were the prepared one. It's like, all right, everybody, here's, have a pen, have a piece of paper. I brought enough for the entire group.
True. I went on a road gig to Mohegan Sun where I performed with a bunch of comedians, and they were two young guys in their 20s. Yeah, comics. Young guys.
Ryan and his dad are great people.
Comic Roadhouse. In Mohegan Sun.
Comics Roadhouse. Yeah. They changed it to Roadhouse now. Yeah. It used to be just comics.
Yeah.
The contest, Last Comics Standing.
It was great. So we drive there
Ryan
to go.
Ryan and his dad are great.
Yeah.
We're also awesome people.
We drive there to go perform, and they're like, we're thirsty. I go, look in the door pockets. I got drinks. So in the back, I got a cooler, and we got sandwiches. And what? Oh, you're the best mom ever! And they eat like peanut butter and jelly and drinking, and they got little bags of chips. And I'm like, come on,
you're
came
giving
with
them
me.
Orange slices.
Yeah, exactly.
You're giving them orange slices after they come off stage.
It's your orange slice. I might use that. I like that. Oh, too funny. But yeah, so anyway, I wrote the treatment. We sat down. We organized everything, how we're going to shoot it. I kind of did it, you know, cell by cell. Like, you know, I had an idea for an act one, an act two, and an act three. I wanted to sandwich those with quotes because I wanted it to be about, you know, people working and then quotes of how they basically went into comedy. They just, you know, the Mark Twain quote about throwing off the bowlines and, you know, just trying something new. And so I had that as a quote. And I had an idea of what I wanted to do. So now I had to find the people, and I had four out of the five. And I asked a friend of mine who had taken a comedy class with me, you know, because I knew her background, and she agreed. So now I have five people. So one is a psychiatrist who worked at Bellevue and the VA in Manhattan. And by day, as a psychiatrist, she has a doctorate in neuroscience and an MD, and a psychiatrist, and she does stand-up comedy at night. Her name is
she's already used
Ellen Orchid.
The crazies.
Yeah, Ellen Orchid. So she's fantastic. She's in the movie. I have a woman. I pitched this to people first. I said, you know, this is what I want to do for a movie. If, you know, do you have any idea what adult protective services are? And they're like, child protective services? I go, no, adult protect. No, what's adult protective? I said, well, abuse of the elderly. And there's there's people who work in that area. I said, yeah. So if I had a person who worked in adult protective services who does comedy at night, they were like, yeah, I think that's really interesting. I didn't even know that job existed. Like, you know, so that's my second, which is Donna Moran. And she did comedy since the 80s, went back to school, got her degree, and then started working for Adult Protective Services. And she speaks about how stressful her job can be during the day of, you know, she works with the homeless, with the elderly, physical abuse, financial abuse. And there's times they don't know where somebody is. They're calling hospitals and trying to track people down. And so, and then at night, gets on stage and does stand up. I have a woman who is a minister and a missioner. So she traveled all over the world as a missioner and is a minister. She's a non-denominational minister. And that's Ruth Ann Bernie Collins. She performs under Bernie Collins. And she does stand-up comedy. So, you know, and she's got some blue humor as a missioner. Some of her jokes, there's two jokes she does that just crack me up. But, you know, she does comedy. I have a guy who is deaf and blind, Mitch Shapiro. Look at your face. He does stand-up comedy. So you're like, how does that work?
I just did, I was at an open mic last night, and there was a blind comedian at the open mic, and he asked if one of the other comedians was still here. And I was just like, am I being an ableist by answering, or am I being an asshole by answering?
Am I an abler?
Is this question rhetorical or necessary to what's about to happen?
Yeah.
Like, am I supposed to wait for that person to say, I'm still here, or do I just go, no, she's not. I don't know what to do right now.
Well, she was supposed to take me off the stage, so I'm fucked. Excuse my language.
Well, the reason he was talking about it is she walked him from the other open mic down the street.
Oh, no. So he really was up a creek.
Yeah. I was like, how are you going to figure out I watched him come to the stage, turn around, and go a different direction back to the stage. And I'm like, I hope he's legally blind. I hope it's just legally blind. Otherwise, I don't know how he's going to find his chair because he went a different direction.
Yeah. So Mitch has two cochlear implants. And so he's got some auditory issues. Although he can hear, he's still hearing impaired. And he's blind. So we have photos of him on stage at Governor's with the dog at his feet, his dog. Yeah. So, but he's a great guy. So he runs a foundation for a living. What he does is he raises money for people who don't have the money to buy hearing aids. So he has, Help America Hear. Help America Hear is a foundation, not for profit. And he is the CEO, and he says he's the professional beggar. He gets all he gets the funds and the funding. So, yeah, so he's in the movie. And then I have Lou Pratts. Lou is the supervisor of the court clerks for Nassau County Criminal Court. So he's in the courts with criminals every day. And he supervises and goes from courtroom to courtroom and is like, I can't even tell you how many courts in the building in Nassau County. And he was a court officer for many years. So he got us to film on the weekend in like the little jail cell and in the courtroom. And he tells funny anecdotes about, you know, working in the courtroom. He said, this place is a joke factory. So, you know, it's interesting to hear his story as well. And so those are the people in the movie, those five. And we followed just those five. At first I had, again, because I have ADHD. I don't know if you can figure it out. I mean, you know, I'm all over the place. But, you know, I was all over and we started to edit the movie and cut certain things out because, like, it's really just about these five. These are their day jobs. This is how they got into comedy. And then the final act is them performing stand-up. And, yeah, so it's you know, it starts off with what do you do for a living kind of thing, interviews, and then it goes into how they got into comedy, and then a little bit of, you know, them performing.
I'm curious as to what did your first draft of the treatment write for someone who has never had to do a treatment before? Was the first, did you finish it and look at it and go, oh, well, this is crap. I have to start over again.
No. I did it and I wrote it and I finished it. And then, so here's another story. I'm sorry, I'm full of stories, but I get.
That's what we're here to do. We're here to talk
I'm
stories
at
about
school.
The things we have to do during the
yes,
day
so
to support what we want to do at night.
Yes, I'm at work as a special ed teacher, and a fellow teacher walks up to me and goes, oh my God, my partner wanted me to ask you a question. So I'm like, what? She goes, oh, she works at, you know, college, Five Towns College, where my director and all the crew came from. It's like a performing arts kind of college, and said, she teaches there, and she wanted to know if you would come and do a presentation on stand-up. So I was like, yeah, sure. So she goes, all right, because, you know, she wants you to do it for, you know, the students there. I forget what class. So I said, yeah, sure. So I call up some fellow comedians, and they're like, what? Go where? Do what? on a Wednesday night? At what time? 4 o'clock? Like, what? So I'm like, guys, just tell me no. You don't want to do it, fine, but I'm going and I'm doing it. So I couldn't get anybody to go with me. So my husband goes with me and we do this presentation for this woman, for the kids, and the students were like enthralled, you know. And again, I don't do anything half-assed. I make a PowerPoint, I've got books, I've got things, we got activities, so handouts. So we get done with this whole thing and I walk up to the woman and I go, so tell me about yourself, like, how did you get into this or whatever, to teach here? And so she's like, oh, she goes, I teach, it was a entertainment business course. And, you know, they were students from all different classes going to this presentation. So she said, yeah, I used to write for Joan Rivers. I used to do this for Alan King. I used to do that. I wrote pilots. I worked on this TV show. And I'm like, these idiots who said, I'm not going to that school. I'm not going to go do that presentation. And so who did I meet? This woman, Rhonda Tenenbaum, who was in the business. And so I knew she had written treatments and things. And I asked her, you know, can you look over the treatment I wrote? And so she sat with me and made changes because there are specific ways to write, like, your opening line that has to be a summation of every single thing you want said in your movie in one sentence.
Yeah, the elevator pitch.
What? Yes. And I literally had an elevator pitch. I was recently somewhere and somebody goes, tell me about your movie. And I had a boom, bang it out within, you know, 2 minutes time as we walked from one place to another. And he was like, all right, hand me a card. And off he went. I was like, cool. My first elevator pitch. But yes, so it has to be, there's log line, scope, there's, you know, all these different words and you had to know what goes where. And so she fine tuned it with me. And then I presented it. And now I have it to where I think it's good enough that, you know, if this ever goes to distribution, and that's a dream, but you never know, right?
Yeah.
So that, have a treatment.
I mean, yeah, that's the hope. Well, this one, I'm gonna give you a great compliment in that you research things. You find out. You don't just dream. You find out, how do I make this dream a reality? And there's so many people who are dreamers. There's so many people that want to do things, but they never make the effort to go out to figure out how to do them.
Right.
And you, like, you wanted to be a comedian. So you went to comedy school. You tried to find out where, how to do comedy. You did your homework. You went and followed up on things. You wanted to make a documentary. So you went out to the internet.
Yes.
Right. It's 2024 and the amount of people that I still have to go, just fucking Google it. Right.
The amount I have of to tell my that students that I ask a question in class and they sit there and I go, you guys have laptops and cell phones. I'm not answering my own question. You're not cheating. Look it up.
Yeah. But, and you did that. And there's not a lot of people at your age and all, like even at my age and people younger than me, that still can't figure out the Google certain things. Like, how do I, but you went out and you got all of those things. You went out and you found the information on how to write a treatment and then you wrote a treatment. That's why I kind of didn't want to ask you how did the first draft look, because I was going to already know by listening to you talk about it that your treatment was going to be on, pretty much on point for the most part because you did
the research first.
All of that stuff is out there. It's not like when we were younger, you know.
The encyclopedia that you got at Walbombs or whatever store you have in your neighborhood, the grocery store, and you were always missing at least two or three letters because mom didn't buy groceries at that store that week. So you were screwed. You had no L. Can't look up Louisiana. Yeah,
I mean, I started in entertainment editing on film and audio tape, okay? And right at the cusp of digital. And I could figure out how technology worked, you know? Like, why aren't younger people who grew up with the technology? Anyway, but rant over with. Congratulations on being smart and doing your research and doing the footwork to figure all of these things out that you wanted to do to make, to actuate your dreams, to use words from the hippy dippy sense, like, oh, if you put it out in the world, what will happen? No, you don't put it out there. You do the
it.
Footwork to make it happen.
So my husband's like favorite saying is do the work. He says that all the time, do the work. And yeah. I got to say, if I told you what we did yesterday, it's insanity, but we did. So I had made, like a month ago, I took black folders, went on Amazon, bought a case of black folders, printed out on an 8.5 by 11 sticker, and yes, Amazon sells stickers, 8.5 by 11, my poster, stuck them on the folder so that when you see my folder, it's got the poster right on the cover of the folder. You open that folder and there's a trifold brochure. And on one side is all about me with my contact info. The cover is the title, the director, myself. When you open it up are all the bios of all the people in the movie. And on the back is what it's filmed at, what speed, what digital processing, what editing, what sound, all of that technical information. That's in the folder. Two press articles from two local newspapers that did articles on me are in there. You know,
hey, put quotes from me in there too. Put quotes from me
excellent.
In there. We'll get pull quotes for you from this podcast.
Oh, that'd be awesome. So I
and they'll go, who is this podcast?
I don't care, man. We I promote you. You promote me. We get exactly. But that's how you put yourself out there, and you see. So I was told about your podcast by another comedian, Laura Patton, who said to me, you know, there's a podcast out there. So what do you really do? And you should look up and whatever and. So she took a picture of, you know, your little blue logo to show me which one and whatever. And so now I go to Google and, you know, you got to get in this deep dive to get to how do I email, you know, Dennis? How do I get to Dennis Mailer? How do I make sure that email goes to you? But yes, I sat and my ADHD makes me hyper focus. And I sent out, you know, my trailer, my website, my this, my that. And, you know, that's how I'm here today. But so the folder has in it also a list of all the theaters, the independent theaters that it's going to be shown at. And then I took a little bit of the treatment, the scope, the log line, and then just the breakdown of the acts. And that's also stapled in that folder with a business card. Staples. Bought a box [S2] Yep. [S1] Of business cards at Staples, threw them through my printer, and broke them up, sat in the living room watching TV. You know,
as an old punk rock kid, I love all of this DIY. I love
totally,
it.
Totally,
man. I grew up doing. I grew up just, you know, when I was managing punk bands, I was pressing promo CDs and making EPKs, electronic, not electric. I was making press kits before there were electronic press kits.
Well, that's it. So I have this press pack, and now I put it all together. My card is in there. And if you scan the two little QRs, one scan is the trailer and the other scan is the website. So the director, John Selecki, and I well, he made mostly the website, but I told him this is what I want. I want an about section. I want bios. I want reviews. So every time we show the movie, that's another thing. Like, I bought this microphone that plugs into my cell phone, and we video. So what'd you think of the movie? Not me. I get somebody. So I had a young kid who's going to school for broadcasting, and I paid him during the premiere to stand in the lobby before the movie and after. He interviewed all the people involved in the movie, and then after he interviewed people, what did you think of the movie? And those clips are all on the website. I strung a bunch of them together and posted them on Instagram, posted them on Facebook, because, yes, I'm old. But comedians use Facebook.
Yeah, we do.
Even the young ones.
When I was just in New York last weekend, and every show that I booked or tried to book, at least, was Facebook Messenger. And that,
exactly.
Every time, every city I go to, if I'm trying to book something that's not already a part of my trip, if I'm going for a festival or trying to book something, I'm finding them. I'm looking up people's Facebooks because
exactly.
They're going to answer it. They're going to have it. That's where the information's going to be.
Exactly.
I don't care how people contact me. Email, Facebook, Instagram. I'm open. I'm out there. Like it's not hard to find my cell phone number on the internet. And the reason I do this is because I'd like to be in contact. Luckily, nobody's used it for nefarious means.
Well, it's funny. I give my students, my college students, my cell phone because I don't have an office. I'm only part time. And my colleagues are like, "You're crazy." I told them they can't call me after 9 because I'm old. So I won't answer anyway. And, set boundaries. And they're fine. I've never, knock on wood, I've never had a problem. But so I made this press packet. So now my husband and I bought envelopes, put them in envelopes, and then went online. And like my son lives in Pittsburgh. So I looked up independent, cinemas in Pittsburgh and mailed out hard copies of the press pack. That I did the same thing with Dallas. My best friend lives in Dallas. So if I can get it shown one night, not looking for anything. So I have a cover letter. I have this whole pack and it all goes in an envelope and it gets mailed hard copy. And then in the neighborhood, yesterday I was at a doctor's appointment in Huntington. There's Huntington Cinema Arts, which is like a big cinema arts theater on Long Island. So we drove with a packet and handed a packet to the guy who runs that. And then we drove to Manhasset and then handed a packet to the cinema arts in Manhasset. And then from Manhasset, which is on one end of Long Island, we drove all the way to Sag Harbor. Because Sag Harbor is on the South Shore, the South Fork, almost out in East Hampton. We drove all the way 2 hours and handed one there and got dinner and got coffee and listened to books on tape and sang in the car. And we had a great day of just driving around.
Trip.
Yeah, road trip. And we had gone on vacation, he and I, in Pennsylvania, and I got these press packets in the car. We pass Bethlehem, the Bethlehem steel stacks.
I'm from Baltimore. But the reason I live in Dundalk and the reason my neighborhood exists is because the next town over was Bethlehem Steel.
There you go.
That company put another factory and made the town that I grew up in.
Wow. So we drove there to Steel Stacks, which is a big cultural arts center, and we hand delivered the pack. I'm trying to get it out there. We entered it into a bunch of festivals. People don't really know how film festivals work, kind of the same as comedy. You pay to enter. It doesn't mean you get to perform. Yeah. So let's say you pay $40 to enter this film festival and 200 people enter the film festival. Well, they keep all 200 people's, $40 that they spent, submission fees, but only 10 get to show their movie. So you could literally put out submissions for 20 film festivals and get into one.
Yeah.
So it's tough, So that's what every, first of the month, my husband and I were like, "Hey, we got our pension check. Let's enter film festivals." And so
I do the same thing when I get a paycheck from work. I'm like, "All right, what comedy festivals am I going to submit
exactly.
my $20-$25 to?" And I have a limit. I'm like, nothing over $25. I'll do 3 to 4, and that's it, and that's what I spend my thing on. And I will defend submission fees because it easily sounds like a scam, and it's not. Submission fees are great, and you know this, but I feel like I got to explain this to listeners who might not know this. They're like, "Hey, this sounds like maybe it's not the best use of your time and money." And it is. it's depending on what
a lot of work goes into
to help go into watching the submission tapes, organizing paperwork, promoting, being able to secure places, being able to financially secure headline and comedy festivals, like having a bank to be able to say, hey, Rachel Feinstein, we want you to headline our festival.
Right.
Here's your guarantee ahead of time. And that submission money goes to those
things.
Right,
goes
to
all those
things. Sometimes you're submitting to a festival that you're not going to get into. But don't think of it I'm putting money into a submission that I'm not going to be a part of. Think of it as I'm putting in submissions for the benefit of the ones that do get in.
Right, exactly. I don't know. Yeah, no, that's a good way to...
We're both in Facebook groups with comedians where you'll sometimes see someone
Some people are so negative. Yeah. You're just like, stop. Yeah. Stop with the negativity, you know? I hear you on that. And I had heard your podcast. You had mentioned about, like, you think to yourself, okay, how far am I going to have to drive for this festival? How long do I have to stay? Do I have a friend whose couch I could stay on, you know?
Oh, trust me. Like, I have 3 months off from work. Two of those months was spent on the road. People have been listening to podcasts regularly have been hearing about the stories of the on road that I use that is saying finger quotes, but it's like, yeah, I mean, all of this was financial losses. Everything outside of when the few months that I owned a car, everything outside of that was financial losses.
Right. But it's an investment in you.
Exactly.
And that's what you have
in my career.
Exactly. So, you know, if I'm going down to Dallas, like last October, I was heading down to Dallas and, you know, I go on.
Oh my God, what week were you in
right
Dallas?
Around Halloween.
God, we were in Dallas at the same time.
So, yeah.
I was at the Plano Comedy Festival.
Is it 2023? You know, it might have been October 4. Yeah, I'm not even sure if it's 2022 or 2023.
We can't keep track of the years anyway.
I can't anymore. I can't even think. But here's what I did. So I go on Dallas Comedy Scene on Facebook and you find some sort of comedy in Dallas word together. Now you start looking, and then you look for producers. Who's producing the show? What's the name on that show? Let me see if I can get, you know, Facebook friend that person and see if I can get on. So I sent out 10 emails with 5-minute clip of mine and to different producers and things. And I got booked at the House of Blues in Dallas, which was freaking, It was freaking cool. It was cool. And, It was like, I couldn't believe it. You know, they sent me a contract in Google Forms, and I'm like, wow, this is not like, hey, here's your $30, kid. You know, thanks for the 5 minutes, you know. I was like, wow.
Here's your $25 and two drink tickets.
Two drink tickets, exactly. No. So that was a cool thing. And then I took the classes at Chicago Second City, and I actually, before I went there, I looked up Chicago comedy scene, you know, and then because of Joke Zoom, I had a friend that was online every, you know, twice a week, and he and his wife picked me up and took me to Lincoln Lodge, and I got to do some time at Lincoln Lodge, and, you know, who's got a show, I can put you on as a guest spot, you can do 5 minutes. So if I'm going on vacation, my husband always says to me, Did you book anything? Did you book anything? And I'm like, can we just go on vacation?
That's why I can justify these things. It was like, this is a vacation for me. Like when I did the Comedy Festival in New Orleans this year,
yeah,
I made sure I went and did tourist things. Cause one, I work in tourism now, so I should probably, you know, support the industry I'm in and also, you know, gather and learn information about what other people in other cities are doing.
Right.
And also get a life worth talking about is a life worth living.
Exactly. You got to be out there and do things. Otherwise, you'll have nothing to speak of. Exactly.
All right. Last two questions.
Sure.
So we've talked about comedy. We've talked about teaching. Is there the logical conclusion? Do you become a comedy school teacher? Do you think someday you're going to be teaching comedy? Do you want to?
Here's the thing is that it's a very small community on Long Island. Okay. And I would never try to compete with people who are already established and who've been in the business for 30 and 40 years. I don't have that kind of knowledge. I have coached people, not going to lie. I have a hard time taking money for it. People will be like, you know, somebody just contacted me today. Can I send you my set? Can you coach me? How much do you call? I go, I don't want to. I'll sit with you. We'll Zoom. We'll figure it out. I don't know. I just, I don't think I'm there yet. To be, you know, I have a comedy coach. I have, you know, people that I look toward. Marion Grodin, who's Charles Grodin's daughter. She's a stand-up professionally.
Oh, the actor, yeah.
Yeah, she's fantastic. So I, you know, I work
I'm
with
sure
her.
Charles Grodin wants to be referred to, remembered
away.
As his other movies, not the one with the big slobbery dog.
I know, exactly. That's yeah. So Marion Grodin, she's my comedy coach, one of my many. Rob, who passed away, Rich Walker, all these people who've been doing this for 40 years, you know. Do I think I'm there? No. Since I started in my 50s, I'd have to be in my 90s to get that experience. I don't know. I mean, I will, like I said, I've sat down with people and looked over things, helped them. They help me. I'm part of that Joke Zoom comedy collective thing that we meet. But I don't know if I have enough knowledge to do it, to teach it right now. And I wouldn't want to sell anyone short. Yeah.
Respectable answer. And the final question is, where can everyone find out information about you? And more importantly, the documentary By Day, By Night, Working to Make People Laugh.
Okay, so I'm on Instagram at Claudia Goodnight Good Life, because my last name is Bonavita. In Italian, it means good life. And I always start off, I'm married 35 years. And the whole audience is like, oh, wow. I go, yeah, keep asking my husband when the good life's going to start, you know. So I, Claudia Goodnight Good Life. I have a website for the movie, and it is www.bydaybynightdoc.com. And you can go online and see it there. If you go on YouTube and you put in By Day By Night, Working to Make People Laugh, you can see the trailer. The trailer is also on our website, so you can see the trailer there. We are showing the movie Monday, March 11th at the Plaza Cinema and Media Arts Center in Patchogue, Long Island. And then on April 13th, we're showing it at Cinema on the Sound in City Island in the Bronx. So that's going to be a fun night. And I'm putting it out there to just see if I can get, you know, someplace to show it right now while we're waiting to hear back from festivals.
All right. Well, we'll talk and we'll see if we can get you here a premiere here in Boston, too.
That would be awesome. I would love it. That'd be great.
All right. Claudia, thank you so much for reaching out and letting me know about your documentary, because we are on the same path of things. So it's so great
it's
to
true.
Find. Like, I love, like, I've been doing interviews for a long time, and I've been very fortunate to have a lot of really big named, well, famous comedians come to me for interviews to promote their shows. And I can say there's a familiarity between us comedians.
Yes.
Once you meet somebody else as a comedian, you instantly know each other. And it's been very fortunate for my career as an interviewer, where I can meet another comedian. As soon as I tell them I'm a comedian, and they realize that, oh, he's a real comedian, not some jerk off that did an open mic once. And they open up. And it's so great to be able to have that rapport ahead of time. So having someone who is a comedian and a filmmaker, and I work in entertainment, and I've worked in TV, film, and stuff like that. It was great to have that feeling of somebody else reaching out and going, hey, we have a common interest. Let's talk about it. So yes. Thank you so much for finding me. Thank you to the comedian who let you know that I existed. Thanks for doing this and telling everybody about it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hi.